We study Torah not just from the perspective of learning abstract ideas and ideals, but the whole purpose of learning Torah is really to be able to apply it to our lives. That's the ultimate goal, because we believe that the Torah is God's revelation, essentially, as to how we're supposed to conduct ourselves, how to live our life, and how to achieve what the purpose, God's purpose in creating us. That's really what the Torah is all about. And as such, it is something that one should turn to in every situation. We should seek to apply Torah knowledge to every aspect of life. So you can't help it, but if you're an American today, or not just an American, this is wherever you're living, there's a very significant event that everybody's attention is focused on. Everybody's focused right now on the war in Iraq, against Iraq, however you want to phrase it. And the point, I'm not interested right now in addressing it or approaching it from a political standpoint. That's something else. A person can have different opinions on that as to whether it's the correct thing to do from a political standpoint, whether it's not the correct thing to do. That's issues of policy. And that's something I guess you study in history or political science, social studies, that type of thing. That's not really what I'm talking about, but it's a matter of importance because it does seem to also contain a moral component. It's become a very significant moral issue. There are many anti-war protesters, a significant amount of anti-war protest, and much of it seems to be on the basis of some type of a moral objection, that it's wrong or it's evil, that type of thing. It's also interesting that many of the other religions, the religious leaders, have taken a position on this. For example, the Pope, who's the leader, of course, of Catholics. As far as I understand it, I'm not an expert on what he says. I think he came out against it and he opposed it. So Christianity has its concept of a so-called just war or an unjust war, and for whatever reasons, the Pope came out against it. Therefore, I think that the Jews and those who take Judaism seriously would be interested to have a certain perspective. What's the perspective that one should have towards this war? Now, of course, you can have a perspective from a political standpoint. That's one thing, and I may touch upon that slightly. That's not really my focus, because you're entitled to have your own political perspective. I'm not saying that the Torah necessarily has a certain political perspective on a particular problem that emerges. That's something else. However, I want to address it from the standpoint of the moral issues. What would be the perspective of Judaism? And as far as this perspective is concerned, I'm going to more or less take certain things for granted. I'll assume that the basic case that the United States is making, the facts, so to speak, I'm going to assume that they are correct. Because if they're not correct, so then that's a different issue. But let's assume that what the United States is saying about Hussein, that the type of cruel dictator he is, and the way he treats his people, and the fact that he's gathering weapons of mass destruction, and that he has connections to terrorism, and he presents some kind of a threat down the line. Let's assume all these things are true. If it turns out that they made a mistake, so then, okay, it doesn't apply. But let's assume that's the case. Still, there are people that question whether we have a right to go to war in this type of a situation, in this type of circumstance. And the main basis for it, I think, would be, there are certain people that are pacifists. That's a very popular position among many people. Many religions, by the way, are pacifistic by nature. And they take the stand that the war is wrong, because they can even point to the so-called Bible. Depends how you read the Bible. Because it says, thou shalt not lo tirzach. And they translate it to mean, thou shalt not kill. Now let me ask you a question at this point in time. Is that the correct translation? Lo tirzach. I believe it's the seventh of the Aseret Dibros. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not kill. So, that's killing. War basically involves killing. Alright, so sometimes you don't kill, you capture. But essentially, if you're going to go to war, you're going to have to kill. So let's say somebody challenges you. Everybody here supports Israel, I believe. And Israel's involved in self-defense. And self-defense inevitably involves killing. So what do you do? What do you do with the pasuk that says, Lo tirzach? which people translate, I think, in most of the English translations of the Bible. I'm not sure. You might find the translation, "Thou shalt not kill." So isn't that killing? So a pacifist, let's say a pacifist challenges you and says that it's immoral. Pacifism. What do you do about all these bad people in the world? You try to avoid them. You evade them. You talk to them. You throw flowers at them. You make nice. You try and use diplomacy with them.
You lie down and
put them. I'm sorry?
You lie down and put them.
Or you run away from them. So how would you answer that question? See, this, you have to know the Hebrew terms. The word for killing per se is hariga. Hariga, laharog, to kill. The Torah does not say lo taharog, that you can't kill, which would be a more general type of a category, which might imply any kind of killing. Lo tirzach, ritzicha, is murder. And the very idea of murder is an unjustified killing, just killing for the sake of killing, or for something which would not justify killing. However, you do find that the Torah itself does justify killing in certain circumstances. For example, the Torah does have capital punishment for certain very, very serious crimes, even though there's many, many technicalities, because it's not to be used very casually. But nevertheless, the Torah certainly does permit killing under certain circumstances. So what I want to try and do today is to elucidate what I would consider to be the basics of the Torah position regarding this type of a phenomenon. Specifically, the challenge, the real challenge that's presented with regard to this particular war is that some people might say it's okay to fight in self-defense if somebody comes to kill you, and like in World War II, where Japan attacked Pearl Harbor, so there was a visible enemy banging at your door, so they might say, okay, in that situation you can fight back, that's self-defense. But here, it's a very different situation, because the nature of this war is more like a preemption, so to speak. That's the whole question revolves around, can you fight a preemptive type of war? Because right now, whatever you want to say, given all the facts that the United States has, no one's saying that at this point in time, before they went to war, that Saddam Hussein was actually in the process of staging and planning a war. His troops were on the way over here with, or his agents with weapons of mass destruction, and we had no choice. No one's saying that. So what I would like to do is to give you a perspective. I had to approach it from the Torah point of view. And of course, if you have any questions, jot them down, and hopefully we'll have some time for it. There's a lot of questions that this will engender. To begin with, I just want to point out that most religions have a certain pacifistic element. Just basically opposed to the whole idea of war. Even those religions that would permit it, you see, they have the concept of a just war or an unjust war. Even then, there's a tremendous reluctance. They view war as being inherently negative. And they're always saying how terrible war is, but what happens is that basically you have no choice. It says you have no choice, because the choice is between being wiped out, having your people wiped out, and you fighting back. So then, reluctantly, in that situation, it's permitted. So the most they'll say is that it's permitted. Is that really the Jewish attitude? Because a lot of people are affected by the attitude of the society that they live in, and Jews also, even if they favor the war, will speak in those terms of a just war and unjust war. Is that really the category that we should approach it from? See, I maintain that Judaism, underneath it all, has a different attitude towards war. You understand what I'm talking about? The world is looking at war as being some unmitigated evil, a terrible, terrible evil. Oh, what can you do? I have to engage. It's sort of a conflict. It's evil, but I have to engage in this type of evil because I just have no choice.
It's a lesser evil.
Right, exactly. As Rabbi Sacks points out, it's a lesser evil. I'm not so sure that Judaism looks at war in the same way. Not that Judaism extols war. We'll see about that. Because in Judaism, you don't have the concept of a just war and an unjust war. What are the categories that apply to a war? What does Judaism call a war that's appropriate?
A correct mitzvah. Very, very good. Well, very, very good. There's the Mohammed Mitzvah. Mitzvah means that it's something positive. Well, a person does a mitzvah, they're doing a good thing. There's a reward for doing a mitzvah. You know, a mitzvah elevates you to a higher level. So you have Mohammed Mitzvah, and there's also even Mohammed Rashad. Mohammed Freedom is an optional war. So there are certain situations, even when you're not being attacked, and even when it's not for the purpose of self-defense, where it's permitted under certain guidelines. You can't just go around killing people. But where else do you see that the phenomenon of war in and of itself is not necessarily to be considered an evil?
Where else, in Judaism or just where else?
In Judaism.
What would be considered basically the primary example of a Mohammed Mitzvah? What's the classical example? There's different instances of the phenomenon of a Mohammed Mitzvah, of a war of mitzvah. Primarily speaking, when the Jews are attacked. So it's a mitzvah, it's obligatory. The classical form of government would be a king, a Jewish king, who rules in accordance with the Torah, has permission to conscript the army, to lead the nation into war. Doesn't even need the declaration of the Sanhedrin. In America, you have war, technically speaking, war has to be declared by the Congress. And in Judaism, you have that type of a concept, but it's not the Congress, there's the Sanhedrin. That would only be in the case of an optional war. If it's an optional war, if the Jews are not under attack, and for other reasons the king decides that it's necessary to undertake a war, he can't do so on his own. He needs the consent of the Sanhedrin. That's the difference between a Mohammed Rashut and between a Mohammed Mitzvah. Mohammed Mitzvah exists in different forms. First and foremost, any time the Jews are attacked. And there, the king, or the leader, it's an interesting question whether the wars that Israel is fighting today, what category would they fall under? That's a very significant question. Because we know, on the one hand, the government that exists is not truly a Torah government. On the other hand, the question is, perhaps it doesn't matter. Perhaps whenever the Jews are attacked, there's an obligation to fight back, and the very war itself assumes the character of being a Mohammed Mitzvah, which would be a very significant question, in which case, it would be obligatory for all Jews to participate in that war. Is it all possible? That's very controversial, because, as you know, there are many Haredi, ultra-Orthodox groups in Israel that decline to serve in the army altogether. The question is whether that's acceptable. Whether that's just because you're religious doesn't mean necessarily you're in compliance with what Jewish law would require. It doesn't always work that way. If that's the case, but basically all the wars that Israel is fighting in modern times have been wars of self-defense by enemies who are seeking to destroy them. They make that very, very clear. But it's another thing which is very, very interesting in talking about the attitude of Judaism towards the phenomenon of war is that if you go back to the role models, to the great heroes of Judaism, to go back to the Torah, to the forefathers, to Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and Moshe Rabbeinu, and Yehoshua, as was just mentioned, Yehoshua, and David HaMelech, these are the greatest spiritual leaders of Israel. And what does the Torah tell you about them? Virtually every one of them was a great warrior, was involved in wars of one sort or another. Avraham Avinu, what war was he involved in? Either you want to call it a war, or would it be a daring commando raid? With 318 men, he took on the mighty coalition. See, history is just repeating itself. Coalition. Avraham Avinu with his band of 318 men engaged in a stunning nighttime night fighting. It's the origin of night fighting. Mm-hmm. Divide your forces. He divided his forces, right, and surrounded his enemy. Speed, surprise. No one could have imagined after they defeated, they came back from this tremendous victory in which they defeated the coalition of the five, the mighty empire. They were going home, and they wiped out all the nations around them. They felt completely safe, and he had the element of surprise. No one was expecting Avraham Avinu to come out of nowhere with 318 men at night. And he defeated them and saved, essentially it was to save his nephew Lot. To save his nephew Lot, and in doing so, he freed all of the captives and brought the king of Sodom was brought back, and it was a tremendous victory. Interesting kind of a war. Because it's not even clear that it was a war of self-defense. So this is Avram Avinu. And God afterwards comes to him and says, don't be afraid, Avram. Anochi Magen Lach, I'll protect you. Schar Chahar B'Ma'od, your reward was very great. It would appear clearly that God approved of his actions. And Yaakov, when Yaakov confronted even his brother Esav, he was hoping for diplomacy, because there are certain situations you have to use diplomacy. Essentially, when you're the weaker party, right, then you go for diplomacy. However, he was prepared to divide his camp. But virtually, and Moshe Rabbeinu, what was Moshe Rabbeinu's reaction when he saw the Mitzri, the Egyptian, was beating up the Jew? He looked around to make sure no one was watching, and he slew him, took up the sword, self-defense. Later on, he fought to defend the girls, the daughters of Yisro, who were being driven away from the well. And Yahushua, and it's not just the great Jewish men. I don't want to leave the women out of the picture, too. Lest women think that they're on some higher spiritual plane. They don't get their hands dirty, but we have heroines. Who are some of the heroines who are known for their great... Devorah. Devorah led the nation. And she extolled Yael, who slew Sisera. So all these things are deemed to be great things. That attitude, that sense, of course, as you know, David HaMelech, the so-called the psalmist, the sweet singer of Israel, wrote all those Tehillim, the highest level of understanding, spirituality, of closeness to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The Tehillim form the basis of all of our tefillos and our prayers. You're not going to find a mightier warrior than David HaMelech, though. Can't be that these people reflect a certain ideal, and it would seem that their attitude towards war, not only was it not pacifistic, that it's begrudgingly the lesser of two evils, you don't get that sense. You don't get that sense when you read about the Shira, the song of Devorah. She extolled the defeat of the enemy and the Shira that we see every day. As Yashia Moshe, after the defeat of the destruction of the Egyptian army. So then how would you characterize the attitude towards war? And of course, I want to include now what you've mentioned before. The Torah commands us to fight an ongoing war against Amalek. Amalek is basically wicked, is evil, is Russia. And that's a mitzvah, that's a great mitzvah. And we see that an individual who fails to partake of that mitzvah, who stumbles in the performance of that mitzvah, is seriously condemned. Shaul. King Saul was involved in the war, and he conducted the war, and he defeated Amalek. But because at a certain point in time, the elements of compassion took over, he spared some of the animals, because the whole culture of Amalek has to be destroyed. And also Agag, the king, he spared him too, which apparently indicated a certain type of emotional hesitation, a misdirected type of a compassion, and that's considered to be a very serious flaw, and he lost his kingship because of that. So how would you characterize the attitude of Judaism towards the phenomenon of war? The Rambam describes the attitude. There are certain laws that pertain to the soldier in battle. The Torah prescribes rules even in terms of what he's permitted to think about. He's not permitted to allow himself to get into a state of fear and start thinking about his children back home, his family, and that whole train of thought that might lead him into a state of weakness or a state of panic. That's a prohibition. He's not allowed to do those things that would cause him to be afraid. And if he does so, it's the worst crime, because nothing destroys an army more than this type of morale. And people see him afraid, then that can infect others. It could lead to terrible destruction, and he's considered to be like someone who's spilling blood if he allows himself to get into that type of state. And this is what he says. He says, "V'chol ha'nilcham b'chol libo," whoever fights with all of his heart, "below pachad," without fear, "v'tia kavanoso l'kadesh es Hashem b'vad," and his intention, the motivating factor, is because he wants to sanctify the name of God alone. Muftach lo, he's guaranteed, shlo yimtza nezek, that he'll never encounter any kind of harm. Velo tagiyehu ra, and no evil will befall him. That is, he's assured of a certain type of protection from God, providence. V'yivnu abayis nachum b'Yisrael, and he'll build a firm house in Israel. V'yizakelo levanav ad olam, and it'll be meritorious for him and his children forever. V'yizakelo chayom abba, and he'll merit eternal life, the life of the world to come. So you see that engaging in this type of a phenomenon is certainly not an evil which we just can't avoid. It's an unavoidable. But to the contrary, it partakes of being one of the most noble activities that a person could possibly be engaged in. It's a positive phenomenon. Why is it a positive phenomenon? As we've seen, if a person shrinks from war, this is a serious sin. It's a serious avera to shrink from war when it is essential, when it's necessary to be involved in that war. On the other hand, to participate in it, and with the proper intention, with a full heart, raises a person to the highest possible level. The Torah's attitude towards war, in my opinion, the fact that war is not an evil, to the contrary. If the objective of the war is to defeat something which is evil, so then that war is good. The reason being, because the way mankind is constituted, since we live in an imperfect situation, and at every point in time there will always be Rishayim, there will always be wicked people who deny the true principles of human life, who deny God, and believe, magnify, deify the power of man. That's the idea of a Moloch. And believe that they have the right to be the masters of the universe. So that's evil. So a person has to make a decision. What's your attitude towards evil? If a person is not disgusted by evil, if a person can live with it, can deal with it, that means to say that that person is not really connected to the good. There's no love of the good. There's no love of God. You can't have it both ways. If a person is indifferent to evil, that's a serious flaw of the whole personality. It's a whole flaw of the soul. So therefore, since evil exists, and if we don't oppose it, it destroys the entire purpose that the world was created for. So therefore, it's a mitzvah. A person who loves the good is obligated. It would be the same thing if you have to defend self-defense, if you have to defend your child. If a person was indifferent, that would mean that you don't care about your child. Since you love your child and you want your child to exist, and someone is threatening to destroy that, so you have to destroy that person. You have to take whatever risks are necessary. That will define and determine your character. That's why it's a different. And the truth of the matter, as has been mentioned, the greatness of the deed depends upon all of the emotions that a person has to overcome. So a person serves God, a person does the right thing, it doesn't cost them too much, so it's fine, good. But the more you're willing, if you're willing to put everything on the line, the greater the love. When it comes to those things that matter the most, you're prepared to put everything on the line. Again, I'll use the analogy of your child. If your child is sick, you're prepared to spend all your money, because this is your ultimate good. This is your ultimate value. That's why war. So therefore, if that's the case, the person is prepared to put his very physical life on the line because of his love of God. That's why the Rambam says it all depends upon the Kavana now. See, if a person has just got that personality, he's a maverick and he loves to fight, that type of thing, so that's something else. He's just using the war as a cover, you know, to be able to have an opportunity to get out there and, you know, kick, as they say. Yeah. That's different. Then he's not fighting for the true purpose. That's why the Rambam was very, very careful, because there's a lot of warlike people that just love it. They just love the action. So a person is doing it because he loves the action, that's one type of thing. Then, I don't know, may not be a good thing. We're talking about a person that really doesn't love it. That would be very happy to stay home and be involved in constructive activity, and studying Torah and other things, his business, and so forth. But he does this because he has no choice, because he recognizes the evil, and because his love of God is such that he can't tolerate that this evil should exist. He's fighting L'shem Shemayim. That is something which propels a person to the highest possible level. So the basic underlying attitude of the Torah is that as long as the world is imperfected, there will always be manifestations of a Moloch, of evil, and when that occurs, So then it becomes obligatory upon those people who love the good to oppose it, and oppose it, if that means that you have to oppose it physically, militarily, so then that becomes your obligation, and failure to do so becomes a defect. Now, that's the general heading, the general category. I just want to add one thing at this point. By the way, the Torah believes there will come a point in history when mankind's nature will be perfected. There will be peace. And because all the people's attention, their energy will be directed towards the truth, towards the knowledge of God. That's the era of the Mashiach. But even then, that will not come about without a very, very big war. The Tanakh talks about the war of Gog and Magog. Even then, ultimately, the triumph of Mashiach, mainly, of course, will persuade people, will teach people, will win people over, but there will be certain elements, apparently, that will not be able to be won over by persuasion, and there will be a war. So peace itself, the ultimate peace, will only come about through fighting a certain type of a war. Now I want to move on to the particulars. That was a general approach. As far as this war, we were speaking about the preemptive war. As has been mentioned, there are basically two types of war in Judaism. And bear in mind, when I discuss this, all the laws of Judaism about war pertain to the people of Israel fighting the war. They don't really pertain to other nations. We're talking about America. So is America bound by the laws that apply to the Jewish nation? It's very hard to find in the sources what the laws would be about other nations fighting wars. But I'm going to try and just apply some what I consider to be general principles, general Jewish principles that I think would apply across the board. As we've said, there are two kinds of war. There's the Melchemet Mitzvah, the War of Mitzvah, and among them, we'll just stick to the one of self-defense. And there's also the optional war, but we're not going to focus on this. Because the War of Iraq has to be understood in the context of self-defense. Now, within the framework of self-defense, the question arises, well, is self-defense permissible only when the enemy is attacking? So it's clearly you're responding because he's attacking. As I said, the case of World War II, Pearl Harbor, I don't think anybody would deny that that's an attack, that's an overt attack. What about the idea of preemption? As I don't think that nobody can make the case that Iraq is on the verge of attacking us and we have to stop them now because their troops are coming here or because they're sending over agents of mass destruction as we speak. I don't think that's the case. So how would you approach this question? Because those who are opposed to it are saying preemption. What is the Torah's attitude on the question of preemption? With regard to preemption, there's different types of preemption. Let me give you two examples. I don't know how much you're familiar with recent Israeli history. You have the case of the Six-Day War. Was that a case of preemption? Well, Israel was surrounded on three sides. And the enemies, Nasser was the president of Egypt at the time, pretty much proclaimed that they were going to destroy the Jewish state and throw the Jews into the sea. So they were in a tough situation. It's very difficult for people who didn't live through it because they achieved a tremendous victory. So when you achieve a tremendous victory, you tend to underestimate the seriousness of the threat before the case, because afterwards it seems, well, the whole thing was no big deal. But I remember the days and weeks leading up to it, and at the time nobody knew that Israel was so powerful and they had this such tremendous ability to wipe out all the air forces and this daring attack, and people were very scared. And that was much, much closer to the Holocaust. So there were talks of tremendous casualties, and they were preparing for burial places inside of Israel because they were expecting massive casualties. And there was a tremendous sense of foreboding. Put yourself in that situation. In that situation, day after day, the news, so to speak, was getting tighter, and Israel was a small country, and you had these three states surrounding them, and all the other Arab states. There was this general nervousness. Nobody knew what was going to happen. At that point in time, Israel brought back into the government the great war hero. Who was the great war hero who had a patch over one eye? Moshe Dayan, to reassure the people. And he made the following statement to the press. What are you going to do? What's Israel going to do? He said, well, we've lost the element of surprise. So as far as that's concerned, we have to wait. It's too late, he said, to go for the military, because we've lost the element of surprise. And of course, Israel was engaged at that time on diplomacy, UN, the United Nations, all these different things, going around the country trying to get support. And he said, it's too soon, it's too early to give up on diplomacy. So basically what he was communicating was that right now we can't do anything except try for diplomacy, because we've lost the element of surprise. Now, who was listening to the speech? Wasn't just the Israelis. The leaders of Egypt, of Jordan, all the Arabs were listening to that speech as well, which was given a few hours before Israel's attack. So they say, oh, okay, diplomacy, let's go back to sleep, we can relax. So at the air bases there was a sense of relaxation, they didn't have to worry, Israel wasn't going to attack. The next morning, Israel came in on all the Arab air forces and wiped out their air forces in one of the most brilliant strikes, air strikes. And of course in desert warfare you see the same thing today. Whoever controls the air controls the situation. Because that's why the Iraqis are not going to come out of Baghdad and fight in the desert. It's an impossibility. Because you have the American much superior artillery, the tanks on the ground facing you, and then you have the planes coming in on the air. There's just no way you could fight. So that was preemption. Israel preempted, and they were criticized for preempting. But obviously, that's not preemption, because that's just an extension of self-defense. They're out there about to attack me, and I don't have to wait until they actually hit me there. Do I have to give them the first cheek? Oh, you slapped me? Okay, now I can hit you back. Now, how is that principle formulated? How is that principle stated? In the Talmud. The Talmud has a very pithy expression to that statement. It's a good one to know. Habola argecha, if someone comes to kill you, finish the statement. Hashkem v'hargo. What does it mean, hashkem? Get up early. Get up early. I know you like to sleep late, but this time get up early. Right? Hashkem v'hargo. Get up early. Early. And kill him. Oh, that's a very significant statement. That means to say that self-defense, it's not justified necessarily as a response to somebody hitting you and you're hitting him back. It means, Hashkem v'hargo means that before he's actually in the act of attacking, if the character of your action, the character of your action is such as its objective is defensive, to remove a threat, then it's permitted. That's Hashkem v'hargo. That's why, interestingly enough, in 1981, Menachem Begin, he's familiar with this history, the relationship between France and the nuclear capabilities of Iraq goes back in time. The French had supplied the Iraqis with the material to build a nuclear reactor. And down the road, if you look down the road, it would be a matter of perhaps years, a few years, before they would be producing nuclear weapons. Then you have to have the delivery systems, the attack systems, and the missiles. And it would pose a threat. I wonder which country had the most to fear from those nuclear weapons that were being planned. This was the planning stages. Very, very far removed from the actual moment of attack. And in 1981, Menachem Begin sent the Israeli Air Force, and they bombed the nuclear reactor, thus putting the whole movement to build nuclear weapons, throwing it off by years. At the time, what was the reaction of the rest of the world? Who was the president of the United States at that time? President Reagan was the president at the time. Every country in the world, including the United States, condemned Israel. However, in 1991, about 10 years later, when the United States fought a war against Iraq, and then they had to consider the fact that they, had they been allowed to develop these nuclear weapons, then they would have been on the receiving end, changed their attitude, and Vice President Cheney, who was defense secretary at the time, sent a letter of thankfulness to the commander of the Israeli Air Force who had been involved in planning that attack. And today the entire world acknowledges that Israel did a wonderful thing. Preemption. preemption. That is to say that, to the contrary, it is wrong to, once you've identified someone who's evil, who's a Russia, who's wicked, and he's involved in preparing, that's habol argecha, he's planning to attack you, then it is a tremendous mitzvah. Had somebody better look at the attitude of the world in the 30s. The whole history of mankind is based upon people who didn't have the capability to think this way. They were this type of a pacifistic attitude. You look back and you study history and you have to learn from history. Throughout the 30s, everybody saw what Hitler was doing and what he was proclaiming and attacking other nations and aggression, and always trying to come up with some kind of an explanation, and nobody had the ability to stand up to him when it would have been relatively easy, until it led to the worst conflagration in history, and of course the Holocaust, because people failed to understand the nature of Amalek, and people failed to understand the tremendous importance of preemption, not to allow tremendous weapons, not to allow the wicked people to gather force and power. That's the worst evil. And this evil was shared by many of the Western statesmen. That, I believe, is the background. I want to mention one more point here before we just tie it into the last specific I want to get into, to tie it into specifically to Iraq. According to Judaism, it's not just that you're permitted to attack the wicked preemptively. According to Judaism, you're obligated to do so, and if you fail to do so, to a certain extent, you're a murderer. That is based upon the Torah. There's a mitzvah in the Torah called Lo Tamod Al Dam Re'echa. You're not allowed to stand idly by the blood of your brother. That is to say, if you're in a situation, there's a fellow Jew in danger. It's not a good Samaritan thing. If you're on the road and there's somebody, or you hear, you know, about a Jew who's being attacked, someone broke into their house, or someone's lost in the road, and you stop, and you go out of your way, and you get assistance, or you help, or you jump into the fray. It's not just that you're a nice person, good Samaritan. That is a mitzvah. Failure to do so, lo tamod, if you're in a situation, and of course this depends upon whether you have the ability. If someone's drowning, you have to jump in and save them. But that's only if you're not a swim, obviously. If you're not a swim, you don't have the obligation. If you have medical knowledge, and it could be helpful, you must do it. You must stop everything you're doing. Thou shalt not stand idly by the blood of your brother. Therefore, if a person has the ability, he's in a situation where he can take out, like the Israeli army has been doing last 2 years, making these strikes against terrorists. They're all preemptive strikes. And that's the whole, and then the whole question arises, in the course of doing so, maybe other people in the building were hurt and so on and so forth. I maintain that Israel has an obligation to go in there and do that, and the failure to do that, if you have an opportunity to take out a terrorist, and you fail to do so because of political considerations, you may be in violation of Lo Tamod Al Dam Re'echa, because what happened? You had a chance to take out this terrorist. You didn't do so. Then he goes ahead the next week and blows up a bus. And all those people, who killed those kids? Who's responsible? Well, first of all, he is. But you, who enabled him to do so, because by failure to remove him, you're enabling him to do so, you also bear. You become an accessory to the crime after the fact. So that if the United States is in a situation, and there's a wicked dictator out there, and he's gathering weapons of mass destruction, and he intends to use them, he wouldn't be gathering them if he didn't intend to use them. That'll become clear. It's pretty clear already. I don't think anybody doubts. Even those who were opposed to war were saying, yeah, he has it, but we should negotiate with him more, because there hasn't been enough time. Because 12 years is not enough time. You need about 150 years. So even those who were against the war were acknowledging that he has them. Anyway, obviously he's going to be using them. It wouldn't take him that many years to use them. Let me ask you a question. If you agree with me, if you don't agree with me that he has the weapons, then I can't ask you the question. But those of you out there who might agree with me that he has the weapons, I have to think the number would be pretty high in this group. This looks like a very intelligent group. Let me ask you a question. What's he going to do with those weapons? What are they being stored for? What are they being planned for? This is a preemption. Preemption that the president says so that he'll, the day will not come when he gets a chance to use his weapons. WMD. You know what WMD is? See? We're all sophisticated. Weapons of mass destruction. When the time would come, let's assume we were to remove ourselves and play out that scene, and they're going to be used in that play, in that script. Who is he going to be using them against? He'll be using them against other Arabs, those who stand in his way, perhaps Kuwait. But essentially, his main objective, I suggest those who are interested, there's a book, interesting book, an expert on this type of thing called The Price of Peace, or The High Price of Peace, I'm not exactly sure, by Joseph Bodansky. The ultimate objective of Saddam Hussein, anyone who wants to get beyond just being the ruler of a country and wants to be the leader of the Arab world, and the documents show this, is to lead, to unite the Arab world. And how do you do so? By defeating the ultimate enemy, which is Israel, and to drive Israel out of the area. That would be the ultimate target. Along the way, he may use it against other purported enemies. He may share it. What Bush was saying was that he would share it with al-Qaeda and other terrorists, which is there's no doubt there's truth in that. There's definitely a possibility. But ultimately speaking, that's who it would be directed against. So, you have a situation of an individual who's already proven that he's unrestrained. One of those brutal, barbaric dictators against his own people. He's gassed his own people. The estimates are that he's responsible for killing about 250,000 people in the most gruesome type of fashion, as has been brought out. No one disputes this. The type of tortures, all of the same type of apparatus as the Gestapo, just not on the same scale. The brutalization, torturing children in front of parents, torturing parents in front of children, utilizing all kinds of degradations, raping, and the total destruction, total negation of any human value against his own people. Aggressiveness against neighbors, willingness to use any type of weapon, ultimately aimed at destroying Israel. A situation like that, in my opinion, becomes, I would raise it to the level of a Mohammed mitzvah. Be a great mitzvah to destroy this wicked person. Now, of course, the United States have the obligation. That's something else. We're not talking in terms of a halakhic thing. The reason why the United States gets into the picture is because we were attacked. And the reason why everybody else, Germany and France, just wants to do business as usual and have a completely different attitude towards it and wants to let inspections is because they weren't attacked. We had 9/11. So then, well, the truth of the matter is, if it wasn't for 9/11, so all these arguments, very convincing arguments, wouldn't be there. Before 9/11, Bush wasn't making the case that we have to go to get. Nothing changed in Iraq after 9/11. I want you to understand that, and that's a big problem that he has. Because if you analyze it logically, and you're telling me all these terrible, terrible things about Iraq, and you're saying why we must absolutely get rid of them, so then why didn't we do something before 9/11? You never heard one word about this before 9/11. That's a very good question. But since I'm not President Bush, I don't have to answer it. But I would say that's human nature. You're right, good point. We were just going about life as usual, business as usual, but that we got the wake-up call. When you get the wake-up call, and now you have to change everything, now you have to address all the issues, then you have to deal with these situations. And you have to, for three reasons I would say, in my opinion, that this is a war which would be Mohammed Mitzvah. The argument of self-defense, because we've recognized that there's a worldwide network of terrorism that we have to defeat, and he's a key figure in the worldwide network of terrorism. There's others, you're right. People can say there's other states, there's Syria, there's Saudi Arabia, there's Libya, no question about it, but you got to take a stand somewhere, and the experts, military experts, have decided this is the most significant place to start. So that's the element of self-defense. Then there's the element of the fact that he's an aggressor. and that he's a sworn enemy of Israel. And his ultimate objective is to destroy Israel. And then you have the element of, so therefore, in doing so, in taking him out, that would be tantamount lo tamar al dam re'echa, not to stand idly by the blood of your brother. That is, all those who would be targeted by him. In doing so, if you have an obligation, by the way, if I'm under attack, I'm permitted to defend myself. It's not just me. Everybody has an obligation. The bystanders. Bear that in mind when you study the Holocaust. It wasn't just a question of the Nazis killing Jews. It was a question of the bystanders. Those who could have stepped in, who could have stopped it and failed to do so, is a very serious issue in the Holocaust. That's the second foundation. And of course, there's a wicked individual. He's a barbarian. He's a Russia, who destroys people, who's an oppressor, who's a tyrant, who's a dictator. And that's the basic theme of a Pesach. A Russia that it's God's will that people should have an opportunity to lead a life in which they're free, in a situation of freedom. They can develop their abilities and have a decent life and so on and so forth. For all of these reasons, I maintain that it is a tremendous mitzvah. Whether we would have the obligation to do it, we don't have the obligation to do it. I'm not saying the United States is doing it because they want to do it for mitzvah. They're doing it because of self-interest. Fine. But that doesn't change the character of the activity. Therefore, in my opinion, what should the role of Jews be in this situation? That is very, very significant. Because there are certain Jewish groups that have opposed the war, have taken a certain pacifistic stance, and there was a big ad in the Times last week of non-Orthodox, very liberal factions of Judaism, trying to make the case that the same type of argument, that Judaism would be opposed to this, and so on and so forth. I don't have I flipped it out, the full page ad. I'll see if I can get it over to Rabbi Rosenthal and he can show it to you what I'm talking about. And you could look at it in light of what we've discussed this morning, creating the impression that Judaism would be totally opposed to this. In my opinion, as Jews and Americans, Jews have an obligation simply to be loyal to the state. That's something which you're obligated to support the policy of the state. Now, you may disagree. I said there's many reasons why a person could have disagreed and said it's not a good policy. But once the country has decided upon this policy, once this becomes the official policy of the United States, then all citizens are obligated to support it. Inwardly, you could disagree. But publicly, you can't do anything that would undermine the war effort. Certainly, as Jews. Jews have a separate, it's a mitzvah of the Torah to the states that we live in. And I'm assuming that when I'm talking about if you're living in a place like Nazi Germany, which is wicked, but this generally stood by the Rabbi Feinstein, the great rabbis, considered America to be a compassionate country. One shouldn't take for granted, if you know Jewish history, the suffering the Jews have had, that I think is something which is lacking in contemporary America, a sense of gratitude, a sense of patriotism. We just take everything for granted. That warrants a different talk. Not at this point in time. But for Jews, and especially in light of the fact that we support Israel, Israel's engaged in the same type of war. And we want everybody to understand when Israel goes in there and attacks, they're not after civilians, they're doing what's necessary to defend their citizens. How damaging would it be if Jews took a stance opposing this war, wanting America to understand our war when we fight in Israel to defend Israelis, and not being totally supportive of the United States and the soldiers in its war against terrorism. So for all of these reasons, my conclusion is that this is a war of preemption, and to the contrary, that's the time to fight the war. Preemptive war is that's the right war. Too bad that World War II hadn't been fought preemptively, many, many less people would have been hurt and killed, and maybe there wouldn't have been a Holocaust. That's positive. That's good. Provided that it's clear that this person is wicked. Provided that he's an enemy. Provided that he's got the weapons of mass destruction. That's the political side of it. I personally am convinced that it's pretty much true. And I think the evidence will show it pretty quickly. If that's the case, my opinion is that it fits into the category of a Mochemes mitzvah, and all of us whatever we could possibly do, as Jews, as Americans, should be in wholehearted support of the effort. A question is being raised that there is a separate issue when I speak about Jews supporting the war, is that there are certain enemies of the Jews. As strange as it seems, there's still some anti-Semites out there. And they're saying that this war is purely for Israel, which is an absurdity. But therefore, if the link between the Jews, if it's perceived that the Jews are so wholehearted, then this might give more ammunition to those who are saying, or making that connection. My answer is it's a good point, and we have to do everything with Seichel. I'm not saying that we have to make extraordinary efforts to demonstrate all of our glee and love and so on and so forth. I'm just saying that our position, like other Americans who support it. I think this is every American is obligated. I think it's highly unpatriotic to have these peace demonstrations now. Now, I'll tell you why now. Because there is a time for demonstrations, it's democracy, and there's a time of debate. During the debate, a person can express his opinion, we shouldn't go to war. That's persuasion. Once the decision is taken, the soldiers are out there now, and you're going out and protesting it. What's your objective? Your objective is whatever it takes to stop it. Do you know what a tragedy this would be if it was to be stopped? Even if it was wrong to go into it, as Henry Kissinger said. Great genius in the field of politics, international affairs, that if the United States were to pull back, or if some scenario, Saddam Hussein were able to survive this, this would have the most horrible consequences. He'd be the biggest hero. So now that we're in the war, to actually advocate a defeat for the United States, or take a position which would hurt the United States, that is the worst act, treasonous, in my opinion. That's strong words. But you have to understand the consequences of what you're doing. In my opinion, at this point in time, any type of demonstration opposing the war is negative. It's anti-American. Free speech? Yeah, there's a time to exercise. After the war, you can critique. Not during, but not worth. I'll give you this muscle. Let me give you the example. I think it's a very good example. Because I'm assuming that those who are opposed to the war, but they agree with the facts. Even France, Germany agree that he has these weapons, but we believe a different method. All right, fine, it's a principal position. Perhaps containment, whatever you want to say. This would be a kid. Let me give you an example. Let's say we were in a hospital. We're working for the hospital. We were for certain rules. And everybody acknowledges the patient had a certain disease, a certain heart condition, or a certain cancer, whatever it is. So then there's a debate as to which treatment among the leading doctors in this team. There's a debate. Some say you need surgery. Others say different type of nutrition and vitamin. Other ones have other types of therapies. So you have a big discussion. But then the overwhelming weight of opinion, which we're all committed now to abide by this. We have a certain way of making decisions. So they decide you have to have surgery. And the others differ. They disagree. So now the others may disagree, but you're committed to go along with the group. Now the entire group has to be involved in the surgery. Let's say in the surgical room, those who are opposed start interfering with the doctors. Now the person's heart is open. So whether you disagree, or even if you disagree with this direct procedure, but now you got to go with this procedure, and if in the middle of the surgery you start to interfere with the doctors, he's going to die. So you have to first of all, you're bound to follow this, because when you sign on to the hospital, you agree that this is the methodology by which we make decisions. So you may not agree with it, but this is the correct decision. Secondly, once the operation actually begins, the patient's life is on the line. Any type of interference is going to destroy him. You have to let the operation go through. I agree with Roy Sachs that we should be intelligent about it, that we should not make it appear that it's a Jewish thing. We should make it appear like we are Americans and participate with any Americans who demonstrate for the war. I think if possible, a person should fly the flag and indicate your complete support for the country, for the troops, and so forth. But not as a Jewish, specifically. Sometimes you do things as Jews. Jews for this, Jews for that. No, I don't think we should have Jews for the war. I agree. Questions being raised about these people, so-called peaceniks, that go out and demonstrate. But they demonstrate in a manner where they lay themselves down on the ground, and they close down streets and close down highways and things of that sort. There's something wrong with these people. because they do not know how to conduct themselves. They can't subscribe to the rules of a system. All of the benefits that they have in this world, in life, is because of America. America's a democratic system. It's like you have this phenomenon. This may be hitting closer to home, but you'll have sometimes children or teenagers that live in a wonderful situation. They enjoy all the benefits that their parents provide for them, the cars and all the luxuries, and they're constantly criticizing their parents and refusing to, they don't know anything, and why should I listen to you, and all that. But meanwhile, these people are as bad as they are. How can they provide you with a life that has all these benefits? So you kind of, that's a defect of the soul. Now, if a person says, look, I don't approve of this family, I think it's terrible and stupid and absurd, so then leave, and you live on your own, and don't take anything from the family. That's one thing. And fine, that's a principled position. Those who maintain that this country is horrible and terrible and warlike and all the things they say, but people have said that, yeah, I think Saddam is evil, but I think that Bush is even worse. I mean, things of that sort. So why are you here? So go to Iraq. If that's what you think, Iraq is a wonderful place to be. Go there. What are you doing here? If you're here, you're a citizen, you're getting tremendous benefits, and you have responsibilities. This is your responsibility. You have freedom of expression. Now, if a person wants to protest the war, even now, I maintain that it's wrong. But you'll say he has a right to speak his mind. But these people, these peaceniks who lie down on the street and stop traffic, are not peaceful people at all. They're extremely aggressive people. That's an act of hostility and aggression. What about people that are trying to go to work? He has long lines. You sit in one of those lines, miles and miles. You hope they're destroying your day, your life. And why? This is very significant. It could be, first of all, some of them get violent, but there's another violence. People have complained ambulances cannot get through to get to a hospital to save lives because they've decided they have a right to not just to protest, but to close down streets, to close down a city. There's something sick about that. There's no idea. An idealist wouldn't act like that. Someone who was a true idealist would say, look, I can't go along with it. I think it's wrong, but I can't go along with it. And I'll explain to you, let them get a bench like they have in England, these parks, stand up on a soapbox and explain to people why you're against it. Use persuasion. But that's a form of aggression. To lay down in the streets, to disrupt, to throw things at the police, these are very, very aggressive people. The point is being made that perhaps there's something more sinister about the psychological motivation of the so-called peacemakers, and that perhaps there's a certain underlying sympathy for evil. That's a very, very serious subject. I agree that it's a very, very sharp insight. Unfortunately, we do have that phenomenon. And that is tied up with our mullahs. That Hitler in his prime was looked up to by all of, not just the Nazis, all of Germany, regarded him as being some kind of a great figure in all of Europe in his heyday. There is that tendency of people to admire the people who embody the worst evils. There's significant reasons, that's a separate study. According to Jewish law, before they would actually attack, the enemy was given notice, the terms of peace, they always, so to speak, sued for peace, gave them the opportunity to avoid war by accepting peace, but the terms of peace, surrender. Also, on the battlefield, they would always leave one area open for those who want to escape. So any foreign soldier that the Jews were engaged in, if he wanted to separate and to escape, not be part of this war, he was not killed. They did have one area. So if they were surrounding the city, they'd make it clear, those, for example, if we were surrounding Baghdad, I'm sure the United States does the same thing today too. Whoever wants to surrender, they'll accept. But more than that, if they just want to leave, and we could kill them, we wouldn't kill them. So they did leave a route for escape. There are many factors, many motivations of those who are opposed to the war. I'm not saying all of them partake of this type of a identification, so to speak, a certain subtle admiration for evil. I'm saying that exists with some people. There's many, many motivations. I can't go into all of them. There's a certain naivete, a certain unwillingness to face up to the phenomenon of wickedness. There are certain people that can't accept the fact that you can actually take little children and put them in gas chambers, and then you can gas 12,000 people a day, men, women, and children. Then you can take children, throw them in the air, and shoot them, and while their parents are watching, as a sport. They don't accept that. They can't believe that. There were many people during the Holocaust that refused to accept all these reports because it's an impossibility. Nobody could be that bad. A certain naivete. You have to know human nature. The extent of evil in human nature. That's what the Torah's trying to teach us. And the Israelis are guilty of that too. Many Israelis, the whole Oslo Accords. Now the Arabs are not out to destroy us. It's a legitimate grievance. If we're nice to them, we give them land, we'll give them the apparatus of self-government, you'll see everything will change. So they went ahead with these things, and this led us to the Intifada. And then it turns out that they're actually indoctrinating all of the children with the message that it's a glorious thing to be a suicide bomber. Does that make any sense? Not in our framework. But there are naive people that don't want to look at evil the way it is, and they want to say that, no, old people are alike. They're hungry. They don't have a land. They don't have jobs. That's why they strap weapons around their belts and they go in and blow buses. Because they're unemployed. It's unemployment.